September 18th, 1996. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
When they came in here, when they had to get railroad rail,
right,
they went around all over the United States and bought up rail.
That was just good steel, right?
Well, they needed 100 miles of railroad track.
Yeah, that's right.
So they got some 100 pound per foot rail, they got some 80 pounds per foot, and they got some 60 pounds per foot. I think they had 40-some patents of railroad, and you would use all the 100-pound rail you had in one pattern, and then you'd have to get a special fish plate to fasten this pattern.
Were they different shapes?
To that pattern. And so one time I was doing a study.
Hi.
Oh, my.
This isn't very fancy, but...
I'm Jim Westcott.
Hi, Jim. Hi. Pleased to meet you. Yeah. Help yourself. There's seven of them cookies.
So I was given the job on duty to make a study of that, and we went to Union Pacific Railroad.
A study to see what you could get away with?
To see about maintenance. Somebody was coming up with a make or buy thing. Do we run our own railroad or do we buy somebody to do it? I was going to Union Pacific to see if they would consider coming in here and maintaining our railroad.
This contracted
out. Yeah. They practically laughed me out of the office when they found out what we had, because they were laying continuous welded line. They were welding on their rail on the flat car and then laying it on the ground and running.
That was kind of modern back then, I think.
But that was just another view of this thin wall steel and...
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
And they did bought used rail wherever they could find it and got enough rail. So we used the 60-pound rail out on some of the siding.
What's rail today, do you think?
Well, your main line is all 100-pound rail.
Okay. That's sort of standard.
100 pounds per foot.
For wheel. Weighs 100 pounds?
Well, let's see, maybe that's from...
Some railroad term or something.
It's a railroad term.
When did you arrive at Hanfordville?
January 25th, 1944.
Yeah, you beat me by 2 months. I was out here about 1st of March.
That was after... The reactor wasn't finished then.
We were in the 300 area running the reactor there, testing graphite and uranium.
That's the little white dome that's there now.
That's 308. And we we went to the University of Chicago, and we were learning to run a reactor. Two, we were testing graphite and uranium there, which was basically to test the quality of of the graphite and uranium that was being used in the 308 reactor, which was built at the basically an improved model of the argon reactor.
That was his first test reactor, serious permanent test reactor.
And so we came out here and ran that. And then in August, we went out to the 100B area because it was getting far enough completed that we could climb up into places and walk around places and crawl in under the pile and things like that to understand, to get familiar with it. In September the 17th, we actually started up
September 44.
44.
Not too long of a time in the
Roosevelt. As a matter of fact, they broke ground for the reactor, I think, in December of 1943. And in September,
that didn't take long.
It was operating.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it, how today it's the exact opposite. Oh, it takes like 10 years to plan and build a reactor.
You can get the environmental impact.
That's right.
Of course, back then you couldn't have filled it out either because you had no idea what was going to be happening. Right?
But you know, when they poured the first pour for the base of the reactor itself, they didn't even have a blueprint for that pour.
You just sort of took your best guess and then went ahead and
they had a hole that was big enough and two poured full of concrete and then allowed it to cure long enough so they could make the second. Yeah. By the time they were ready for the second pour, they had blueprints for that pour.
It's interesting because if you read about like the Liberty ships in World War II, it was kind of the same thing, a more standard product, They were building them in times that nobody ever would have imagined possible.
But when we were probably October 1943, when we were at the Argonne, the DuPont design engineers were bringing in sheaves of blueprints for the 100B reactor building. Mm-hmm. And they would present them to the physicists, and the physicists would critique them. Because DuPont knew enough, all there was to know about building and operating plants, designing, building, and operating plants. But they didn't know physics.
Yeah.
So they had to come in there and get the critique from the physicists as to what they saw as a possible objection to this thing. And they would take a sheet of blueprints back to Wilmington and make modifications on the scene. About 10 days later, they'd come in with another batch of blueprints.
Right.
Now, of course, the reactor was already built, but we were studying the discharge area and the interface of a 5-foot wall, concrete walls on the back face of the scene. So, but that was designed being built.
Yeah.
Now,
were you working for DuPont also?
Yes, I worked for DuPont beginning in 1937 and in Tennessee, and then I moved up to Delaware, up to our first nylon plant when the war started.
The first nylon plant?
First nylon.
Yeah, that was pretty modern, I guess.
Right.
You started in 37?
Pardon me?
You started in 37?
I started with DuPont in Tennessee at Old Hickory.
I started in July 36.
Did you? Yeah.
But you didn't make enough nylon for parachutes and stuff. Were they still using silk for a lot of that?
They were used most of it for women's stockings.
Really?
Nylon.
When the war started, that's where it was going?
Well, the war hadn't started yet when we built the nylon plant.
Well, that was probably the best way to make some money on it, too, right? What else? You don't even know what it's good for yet, probably.
Yeah. And the war started, and they moved me out to Ohio for Remington Arms. We were making ammunition out there, King's Mill.
Yeah.
And then Walter Carpenter came along and interviewed me for Hanford. And I moved out here just, I guess it was February and March of 44. They gave me enough gas stamps, so I drove out from Ohio, and it took me 8 days to make it.
Back then,
The speed limit was 35 miles an hour.
The roads weren't good for much more anyway.
Do you have any blowouts on there?
I didn't have any blowouts. I had a freeze-up going out of Little America, if you know where that
is. Wyoming? Yeah, it's still there.
I didn't warm my engine up when I took it out of the garage.
The radiator was frozen?
The radiator froze up.
Yeah.
I drove from Little America to Richmond in one day.
Did you? Oh, yeah.
More recently.
That was a long day, though. We drive to Pocatello very much, then, because one of our daughters lives in Pocatello.
So how many people do you think DuPont moved out to work on the bond project, to Hanford or wherever they were?
Construction or office?
Well, that's the thing I'm not sure of, because they were in charge of both, right?
No, they were in charge of both, but...
So it wasn't just a few hundred DuPont workers, it was like in the thousands?
Well, I guess I'm confusing something, though,
because all the construction workers, who were they working for?
They were subcontractors.
They weren't directly DuPont employees.
No, that's right.
They were recruiting all over the United States. Right. They were bringing them out here, and I was reading one of the DuPont, or one of the DOE, the AAC brochures, and there was 50,000 construction people on the site.
Yeah. So how many people like you, though? There was probably a couple of thousands of engineers, designers.
I would say more than 1,000. I don't know whether it was 2,000. I'm not sure either.
But
they were hiring from Remington Arms. They were hiring from any place.
Any DuPont facility.
And basically, my history, I started in July of 36. I was working at the Xerox plant as a checker. And they put me in a plant where they were making a new product for Mammon, which was to be used in another plant, which was a new product, which was Lucite.
Mm-hmm. Lucite?
Yeah. And,
which is their trade name, right? Mm-hmm. Lucite was a DuPont trade name, but nylon wasn't?
No, nylon was DuPont.
Yeah, it was.
Yes, indeed.
And so basically, I started in this for Mammon and as an operator. I worked in the Lucite plant. We were making the Lucite monomer, not the solid. So I was in a startup there, and I was a startup in the other one. And then basically my history with DuPont was starting up new projects. And then we went into December 1940. I went up to New Jersey to train for on a plant there that they were having nitrobenzene and stabilizing for gunpowder. And after there, and I went to the Indiana Ordnance Works to start up a plant there. And so basically, then I went to Oklahoma Ordnance Works and started up another plant just like it there. So basically, my history was starting up new plants. Mm-hmm. And I think that primarily was the reason that I was chosen to go there, because, and I think it was about March of 1943, I was told that I would go work with this man over there and we're going to start up a new project to make a substitute for TetraSOS. And he said, but you won't be there permanently. You work with him, but you... So I think at that point I was designated.
So tetraethyl lead, backing up on that, is what they put in gasoline? Is that the same lead they put in? Okay.
It was, of course, in short supply.
Not very exotic compared to coming to Hanford.
So they were making they were starting with a nitroxylene product. And then...
Now, were you a chemist?
Chemical engineer.
Chemical engineer, okay.
So basically that was my... But I was just about to tell Tom that they didn't have time to redesign this process. So they went up to, they sent up engineers up to this Rufano place in New Jersey, and they copied and measured everything in that plant. And basically, well, had gone in and bought garbage pails out of the surplus yard at the in Philadelphia to use to receive the sludge and the Hanlon product in their nitrobenzene process. So what do? You get the Indiana Ordnance Works, and there are the duplicated garbage pails from the surplus yard in Philadelphia. You go to Oklahoma Ordnance Works, and there they are again. They put tanks on end, 9 by 30 foot tanks on end, lines there, so that you get be able to separate the sludge from those fills. And they copy those identically.
Yeah.
So you go there. In March 1942, I was told I would be going to the Oklahoma Ordnance Works in September. 1 week later, they came in and said, "How soon can you leave?" And the reason I was there was that the pipe fitters at Oklahoma were pipe fitting this still house from a flow diagram. They did not have blueprints.
Wow. Yeah. Those are craftsmen for you, right?
Yeah.
You
can do that. But that was all that was available.
That's great.
So I went out there, and there was a vacuum still in this still house, and it had the fluid lines and the condensate lines and the vacuum lines all there. And in order to make the flow sheet more understandable, they had run the vacuum lines around the perimeter of the drawing of the flow sheet. So where do you suppose the vacuum lines were in the still house?
Looks like a work of art, huh?
Around the perimeter. I said, "Okay, you take that out there and take this line and put it on the floor there."
Right off the blueprint. That was the blueprint.
That's great. Well, so everybody was kind of building things that way, right? It's just that the B reactor had never, it was all, I don't want to say it was guesswork, because it wasn't. I mean, they knew it worked.
No, they had blueprints.
But nobody had ever built one before. Yeah.
I was reading a DuPont, or an AEC or DOE report here before I came over here, and I was reading some of this thing about the background of the DuPont was brought into this operation in about October, I think October 1942, and Crawford Greenwald was at the Stagg Field in the stadium in December 1942, when Jeremy was testing the test reactor that they had built in Squash Court. And on that thing, they had a hand control horizontal rod.
Yeah.
They had a vertical rod over a pulley, tied off the cleat over the wall, and they had a man standing there with an axe so that he could cut that rope in case something happened. And Jeremy was standing on top of the reactor with a 2.5 liter bottle of
oil.
And a hammer. He was the third thing. But another thing.
Well, it's funny though, is because it never really changed from that in a way. I mean, they knew what, back at the very beginning, what it took to moderate a nuclear reaction to a certain degree. You got control rods, emergency rods, and a total shutdown scenario.
But if the pile should shift or something, earthquake or whatever reason, and the rod wouldn't go in.
Yeah,
then you'd have.
But they had taped Indian foils to the trees in front of the apartment buildings around the state of the estate.
As a target to see if anything came out?
So that in case an uncontrolled reaction there, they would be able to count the Indian foils and figure back to how much.
Now, it never got to any dangerous levels?
No.
Yeah.
No, but the thing with isn't, I don't think you realize it, they were considering two kinds of uncontrolled chain reaction. In other words, to control the their possible uncontrolled reaction in uranium, or that it was possible that if you got an uncontrolled reaction, a chain reaction going, that it could cause a chain reaction in other things, and it was actually the Earth would become part of the reaction.
Yep. Always that possibility lurking
there. And at this point, they didn't know. Because this was the first time that they got a reaction going.
And by the time the B reactor actually got going, people felt pretty comfortable that it was going to be under control and that they knew what to expect within limits.
And Fermi was right there, too.
Right.
Yeah. DuPont had 59 degrees and shutting the thing down.
Yeah.
But we had, you could not operate the reactor unless the power lines to Grand Coulee and to Bonneville were connected to a loop, so you had power from two sources. You had the horizontal rods were hydraulically driven by oil, and they had three service station lifts down there in the room just off.
Just like the gas stations had for cars?
And there was a big tank full of rocks.
Oh, yeah.
And before you could operate the control rods, you had to pump those tanks up to the place where it had that potential energy of there
to shove the rods in later.
If power failed, closing would be enough to drive the rods.
Now, were the rods one long continuous rod?
Yes.
So if something jammed in the middle, would it stop the whole thing from moving?
No, it might stop one rod.
No, but the whole length of the rod would not be able to.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they, let's see.
How many rods were there, Bill?
There was 28 vertical rods and 29 vertical rods and nine
horizontal.
Which were the control rods?
They were the control
rods. The horizontal?
Horizontal, yes.
And they had many more for the emergency or total shutdown?
Yeah, the emergencies would fall into the reactor. Emergency rods.
Yeah, any sort of a dozen different things, either radiation in the work area or overheating of water coming out of the rod,
right,
or loss of pressure on any one tube going into the tooth out of the tooth. Any one of those things could check
it. It wasn't a daily event, though, was it?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We had a pressure gauge on each and every process tube. There were about 3,000 process tubes.
2004,
okay. That's right, in the first reactor. You're correct. And any one of those gauges, if the water pressure would go way up or go way down, the gauge would scram the reactor, shut the reactor down, and the rods would fall. So
incidentally, the term scram was named after this guy with the axe.
I heard that. I still don't believe it. Safety control rod.
Axeman.
I just, the word was around before that, I think. That's what I wanted to check.
You've got to remember, Fermi had this sense of humor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I totally believe
that. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Because that was a real basic safety system, right? A guy with an axe.
Oh,
you can't get any better than that.
That's great. But, so, that's just...
As far as running the reactor went, in a way it was no different than running any new engineered plant, whether it's making nylon or lucite. It was a lot of chemical stuff, it was a lot of control stuff, it was a lot of pipes, a lot of engineering, but even the actual thing it was doing had never been done before. Everything that was built around it was built under the standards and under the knowledge of the time, and had people who could have worked in any plant, because a lot of the people didn't know what they were working on, right? It was just a big engineering type processing plant.
Carl Mern was one of the supervisors in the test reactor down in the 308 building. And we were operating that one time, and he allowed his 9-year-old son to run that reactor.
You pull the rods out and push them in.
Yeah. He about got his head taken off for that remark.
Did you say it publicly, like as a newspaper or something?
Well, no, I mean, just his philosophy, his
attitude,
conceiving the idea that a 9-year-old kid that operated that thing, they almost wiped you out. They all went to sponges in, right?
That's funny. I tell you, though, when I was in elementary school in the 50s, what I learned about nuclear energy almost made it seem that simple, because the basic concept is you take a block of uranium and you put another one near it, and the closer they get, the hotter it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people thought you could power an automobile from it, because they were under the misconception that it was that basic.
Mm-hmm.
Because compared to a lot of other ideas, to a layperson trying to explain it, you have to say it in simple terms. And therefore, I ended up with this concept that it was real simple.
But then there was the physicist at Los Alamos who was guessing two hazardous shim plates between them. And he wanted to remove another plate, and he read one with a screwdriver and pulled one out. And the screwdriver slipped.
I think I read about something like that. Yeah, it was one of those situations where it was totally safe until the geometry changed or whatever. Yeah.
And of course, the fact that it said he was approaching critical, and he removed a fairly thick plate.
Because they were literally like putting in 5 thousandths of an inch and measuring.
He kept across the threshold and became there, and before they could knock it apart, there was a blue flash.
Yeah, I read about that. And that was all just trying to calibrate how this stuff worked.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Trying to get some figures to work with so you could build a reactor.
Yeah. In that case, they were trying to get the information to build a bomb.
Yeah. I guess Fermi was doing this kind of stuff back at Chicago to build a reactor, trying to get their values down before they went ahead and designed it.
Well, he was out here for the startup.
Well, as a matter of fact, he was responsible for and directed us to bring every reactor there up to critical, including the 308 building, the 100B, 100C, 110. He was present, he was the authority every time, and so basically he'd say, okay, we were loading basically a conical pattern, and you were starting at the bottom, so he said, okay, you load with at least 300 tubes. So you go ahead and load those, and then pull the rod and see if anything happens. And then he'd tell you, okay, now 200 more. And he knew approximately what the answer was going to be.
Yeah.
But so basically, after we got the forces of time, then you have to reach it.
Now, you knew what you were working on as soon as you got there?
Hmm?
Did you know what you were working on as soon as you got there? Did you get? You did.
As a matter of fact, we were in July.
after you went in?
43.
43 before you went.
Yeah,
okay, so you were one of the people who was prepared to understand what was happening. How about you, Tom? Did they tell you what it was?
No, they didn't tell me. I, in 44, although Walter Carpenter was the one that, he was the head man for DuPont, he was the one that interviewed me in Ohio and told me to come on out here. And so I did. And at that time, they sent me to 300 area. This time, they were working on all the different instruments that would measure radiation and anything, and control all the equipment that was needed for the reactor and for the water plant also.
Were you using all those words back then? Were you using radioactive and reactor?
Well, I think we were radioactive because we had...
some people didn't know that, right?
Yeah, I know. The Beckman instruments were connected to ion chambers, which were to measure the radiation level at that particular point.
But the reactor was 40 feet cubed, a block of graphite with 10 feet of shielding on the outside. By any standard, that's a pile.
Yep.
Now, the pile was, that was the name.
That's right.
Crawford was dreaming of was a research chemist and was working with the physicists back there, and he was present at the testing in the West Ham on December 2nd, 1942. And of course, he later became the president of the company.
Okay.
But he was also present in the control room. And the other guy,
the what was it, Xenon?
Xenon, boy, that was the Xenon.
Now, had anybody predicted that?
Well,
they were testing.
I think it was Anderson, and of course, Fermi had done a lot of research on the different radioactive elements and on their half-lives. So when the thing died, there was a group of people in the office behind the control room. I was on the ship. And they were waving their arms and they were talking, and this is Fermi and Wigner and Greenwald and maybe a dozen other people. And so my boss came through there, and I said, after a while I said, Jimmy, I said, what did they decide? What did they decide? Possibly. He was puzzled, and it looked like I asked him the wrong question. Virtually, he broke out in a grin and said, oh, he says, you know what they were doing? I said, no. They were making up a pool, and what time was going to come back to me?
And I wonder, were they close? I mean, they knew what was going on.
Well, somebody was close.
Yeah.
Somebody probably chose the right half line.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it sounds.
So when the war was over, DuPont said, we're done now. You go find another contractor.
Well, of course, the world went over.
No, but in 46, let's say.
September 46, they were out.
Yeah.
They went back in and got into the Savannah River later on.
So who did you guys work for after DuPont?
GE, General Electric.
Okay. They were the main contractor. They were the only contractor.
I worked for DuPont, GE, Isochem, and then Richard Red.
Who's the one after GE? DuPont, GE, and then
Isochem.
Isochem?
Isochem.
They didn't have the 100 areas, did they? Isochem.
No, they did not. After GE came in, they began to break up.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was in the hundred areas all my working life, and it was DuPont and GE, and then I even forget the interim. Who's after GE?
How long was GE there? For quite a while.
Yeah. I might have it somewhere.
ISOCAM was a combination of U.S. rubber and another outfit.
That was after GE?
Yeah.
There was a company called Nuclear by then? That's great.
Douglas United this year was their official.
What year do you think that was?
Oh,
give or take. In the 50s?
No.
Oh, really?
It was more of the late 60s or early 70s.
So GE was there from like 46-ish on through?
They were there quite a while.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, I remember going back to Schenectady one time on business, and I was looking up something for the instrument group back there.
Let's see, in 1950, I went back to Schenectady.
Yeah.
And at that time, GE was planning to build a more or less a fast flux reactor at West Milton, New York. And I was looking at Sarasota, Saratoga Springs, as a possible place where I might live, there, because I was going back to operate that, to be in charge of the operation of that reactor. And while I was there, the AEC cancer project. So I came back, and of course I was out of the reactor at that point, and then I went into administration.
So when DuPont left, the war had been over, not very long, I guess. They left within a year of the war being over?
Yeah, actually.
Okay. And at that point,
I remember, was it October they left? Yeah.
I would say
October 45 or 6.
46.
About a year later.
Remember, September the 30th. This is the end of the fiscal year. October the 1st was the beginning of the new year.
That's right.
So that's probably
when they took over.
So the war ended in August 45, and by October 46 they had moved?
Yeah.
Okay. The GE came in.
Yeah.
And you guys were working for DuPont.
That's right.
Temporarily, because it was a war project, you thought that was what your intentions were,
well,
living in a temporary town.
They told me, when I found out there, I was probably a year, 2 years. And of course, when they left, they offered me a job. Go back. Back to what?
DuPont didn't want to lose all their good people, I guess.
They offered me one, too.
No, yeah.
That wasn't that, well, okay, yeah. But I was offered a job to go back at basically the level that I left at. And I had been a supervisor, a shift supervisor at the time, and now there were no more shift supervisors. They had engineers. So I was an engineer. So the people that had left later had higher positions and were able to come back there. And so that was not very entrancing.
Let me ask you
ask a more basic question. When you were working for DuPont before coming out here, and then they said, we're going to shift you out to here, was there a major change in salary and things like that?
Oh, there was a little raise.
Not a major. I don't know whether you call it a major, but there was...
Because I know some of the trades probably got a lot more money. Some of the guys who've been making sort of moderate... Well, you guys were professionals, though.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So you kind of just lateraled...
You went up a little bit.
Okay.
No,
so how about then when the war was over, DuPont was leaving, they offered you other jobs. Was the pay going to be similar?
Well,
how's that going to work?
What it would be was you'd go back there at your same salary. But you would be in a lower position. And
in the pecking order.
So basically, you went back there and you were an engineer at a plant with all these other ones in there, and they were shoulder to shoulder with people. And if they picked you out and sent you to one of the other plants, the job just closed up. That job disappeared because they were making space for you until they could get you into another.
So the basic question is, what was it that made you decide to stay here as opposed to going back somewhere else?
Primarily that was number one, and I was offered a fairly substantial improvement at a higher level and chief supervisor.
Staying in the new industry out here. Did you like the area enough to stay?
Yeah.
At the time? Yeah. Okay. How about you, Tom?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Well, DuPont asked you if you wanted to go somewhere, and you turned them down.
I turned them down right on the right off the bat, because I didn't even know where they wanted me to go.
Yeah.
Because when I got out here, I was single. I had a vacation in June of 1944, and I went up to the Lazy F Ranch in Ellensburg, and I met this young lady up there, my wife, and we were married in August of 44, you know. And we didn't get a house in Richmond until December of 44, I think it was, to get a bee house.
So December of 44, so 9 months, 10 months, less than a year later, war was over, another year, DuPont was leaving, offered you a job. You had already established here?
And already established, and my wife's family were living in Seattle. And then I decided to buy a farm over in Kennewick in 46, right? 46, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I did.
A farm, like a working farm?
Yeah, 12 acres and a lot of 5 acres of asparagus, and 100 apple trees, and 100 peach trees, and a bunch of cherry trees.
Probably not there anymore?
It's all filled up now. Yeah. The house is still there where we live. But there's a lot of industry to move in there.
Came from West Virginia, and you knew exactly.
That's interesting to hear. Where were you born and raised?
Morgantown, West Virginia.
So you weren't used to it? When you came out here, you said, oh, it's dry. How nice.
That's no DuPont town, isn't it?
My wife's sister came out here, and we were sitting out in the yard one time. He said, it's hot. I said, yeah, but it's a different heat. It's hot.
But nonetheless, I lived in South Carolina for 4 years, and not in the hot part. We were up in the Piedmont area. And if you're dressed like for Hawaii, it's not bad.
Yeah.
You know, the loose clothing, shorts, in the shade, sipping a cool drink.
Yeah.
But if you're leading a normal life and wearing a suit and driving a car, it can be pretty miserable. And that was, before air conditioning.
Yeah.
I don't know, it must have been pretty interesting.
Of course, living in an F house here upstairs on a hot summer day, that would be interesting too.
That's right. Okay.
Our little house heats up 10 degrees above whatever it is outside in the summertime.
Yeah.
Just going to heats up.
Well, when DuPont built the houses originally, they didn't put any air conditioning in them.
They hardly had it back then.
They give you a furnace to heat it up,
yeah,
and give you the cold to put in the furnace. Yeah. But then
and you gave you a 3-step ladder and you were a kitchen stool.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You did the hose and the ceramic water connectors. I fed water in your lawn.
Yeah.
You gave you grass seed.
That's right.
And that carried on after the war?
Mm-hmm. No. No,
that was...
Okay, what was the situation? The city didn't get incorporated until the 50s, right?
No, it was before the 50s.
58,
yeah,
I think.
No.
I think it was
40.
After that. 48.
No.
Look it up.
The city didn't become its own city until much, much later. And what that interim period was, maybe it was something in between, maybe. But you just... Who did you rent a house from? Or who did you... You didn't buy a house then.
You rented the house from the AUC.
Okay.
Yeah, complicated.
I guess it was maybe and then at some point they sold off the houses in the town.
Yeah. 1948.
Right.
But you were living in Kenilworth by then?
Yeah, we moved back here. We moved in this house back in 1948, though, this house right here.
How long were you in Kenilworth?
Not very long, just a little over a year, because it would, when I moved out there, there wasn't much construction going on here.
Right.
But then the construction started started going way up. It would take me 1 hour to drive from Kennewick to Richland, another hour to get out to work.
Wow.
So that would be 2 hours one way, 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
So that's the reason I moved back.
Now,
right
did you
here.
Guys literally like drive out to the B reactor to go to work?
Yes. Buses.
Took a lunchbox and drove or took the bus, and that's like an hour from Richland even now.
Oh, yeah.
That's a long, long way.
That's right. Could take the bus.
Yeah.
Early.
Okay.
You could get a bus close to your house.
Oh, yeah.
Or you could drive it out to the bus lot.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, the original bus lot was right up here. Right up here. Just right
where
the sheep hill.
Up here.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Where it's all filled up with houses now.
Okay.
But
the two times I've been out there, I've been very impressed at how far it is.
Yeah.
It's a long, long drive, and you're out in a whole other part of the country.
Right. Yeah. So, that was quite an experience.
Yeah.
I can remember coming in one night with a bus driver, and the buses were then, they had plywood seats with upholstery cushions on them. And we were coming home in a dust storm, and the bus driver was chasing jackrabbits with the bus. Because he was going to terminate the next day.
He was through.
He was tired of it.
One time I was over at the station in Pasco to get tickets. We were going to go out in a couple of days. And we go into the waiting room in the train station. And every bench, the benches in that station were 75% occupied. Any time of the day. And when the guy came in there one time, I was there, he came with a couple of suitcases, and one of the guys said, "Oh, no. Where are you going? I said, "I'm getting out of this place."
You know?
Right. Last week, I was down here, and by the time the train came, I was so drunk they wouldn't let me on. And I've been down here, and I'm sitting here until the train leaves. I'm getting out this time.
Whoa. Well, I guess if you guys didn't have jobs that were kind of interesting and exciting, you might not have been so interested in staying here. You know, if you'd just been working in a nylon factory in Richland, you might have thought twice about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Right. My family was Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania. So that would have made quite a difference. Since I married a young lady from Seattle, that made a big difference.
Yeah, too. Yeah, a big connection.
And by the time we moved to the farm, we had one child, and before you knew it, we had, after we moved here, then we had, we wound up with five, so five children.
Yeah. I guess it sounds similar because my, when was it? My father was already living in Los Angeles before the war started. My mother came out a little bit before the war, but they ended up living there afterward along with a whole bunch of other people who had been through there during the war. Because LA was really sleepy and San Francisco were fairly small cities. And then after the war, what happened in Richland kind of happened all up and down the West Coast, of, you know, in Seattle too. People who had never been there all of a sudden went through it in the war, liked the place, didn't know where else to go after the war, I guess, and offered a lot of opportunity.
Yeah.
Richland still seems like a small town to me. It still seems like a fairly small city, but who knows?
Just about right.
Yeah. Very comfortable place to live.
Right.
Very easy. Yeah. You want to dry your, or wet your palates a little bit? You want some?
I might have a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get you guys talking.
Yeah.
Sort of trying to think about what we could put in the newsletter for the B Reactor group on a regular basis. No, there's all kinds of stuff, I think. It's a question of figuring out what's possible. Because we don't have 20 pages a month. We don't have infinite amount of time and pages. But it seems like...
You want a cookie?
I don't believe. Oh, say yes. You thought about it. He wants one.
He wants one?
I think so. Okay. Let me take him over there.
Sure.
Can you turn it down in person?
That's great.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
When I was in Sacramento, I lived next door to a fellow who had worked for Union Pacific or Southern Pacific Railroad. And this was in 1980, and he had retired like in 1951. And he retired like when he was 70. He was a very old guy, and he had had a whole other, you know, experience after working for the railroads. He quit just when they were shifting over from steam to diesel. The diesels were coming in, and everything was changing drastically. He said they used to bring a steam engine in for a rebuild, and you literally took the whole engine apart because the whole thing was an engine. And when the diesels came in, they just, you know, brought a crane in, pulled out the engine, and popped in a rebuild, and the thing was gone in a day, probably. And it was like a whole different industry all of a sudden. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Those transitions come along. What I'd like to see in the newsletter at some point is just sort of an ongoing, you know, whether it's a bit in a piece, just a little snippet of a something, or some kind of a short article about, you know, experiences at Hanford, or interesting incidences, or talking about the materials that went in, any kind of a thing like that, I think would be of interest to anybody who picks up the newsletter.
Yeah.
Because right now the newsletter has business type stuff in it, you know, what the membership is and what Jerry says is going to be happening. But there's no vehicle for getting out some of this historical stuff and some of the things that actually happened. And I think it would be valuable. I think people who wonder what the group is and they see the newsletter and go, oh, wow, this is the kind of stuff that was going on back then. This is where... This is why people want to preserve the B reactor. Because nobody's interested in preserving a building.
Yeah.
You know, buildings have no significance at all. It's what went on and what it represented and what the people were doing inside of it.
Yeah. I remember it was in May of 1944. They sent me down to California to the Beckman Instrument Company. they were making the Beckman instruments that would be used for basically controlling, helping to control the reactor. In other words, they were connected to ion chambers that were located underneath the reactor where they sensed the change in radiation.
Right.
And these Beckmans were they had a meter right there before the reactor operator, and they also had a trip that automatically shut down the reactor if it went up too fast, too far. So, but that was real interesting, and somebody told me, he said, when you get down there, why, go over to the L.A. Library and get out this book and read it, and you'll understand what's going on at Hanford.
Huh.
And,
what book was that? Or was it a publicly available book?
Yeah, it was publicly available, yes it was.
Yeah.
Maybe you remember.
I'm trying to think of the so-and-so report.
Yeah.
Not the Smythe report.
Huh?
The Smythe report?
I think it was the Smythe.
That was one of the early ones. It sort of talked about the Manhattan Project.
I think it was probably the Smythe.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't the Smythe report. I don't think. I think it was a report. I think. I can't remember whether Fermi was involved with it or not. He may have been.
But it was about Hanford and that process?
It wasn't about Hanford, but it was about the process.
Okay.
About the process, the nuclear process. So they said if you read this, you'll find out what we're doing up here at Hanford.
Yeah.
So,
kind of hard to explain your job, I guess.
Yeah.
It was still secret after the war, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
An awful lot of secrecy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one time I went to the University of Chicago, where I was the Argonne. Mm-hmm. Several of us were sitting around in the library. And Jeremy was there, and he was sitting on a desk, and I was sitting on a desk. He said, you know, I think DuPont's going to acquire too much trouble in this building. Well, what will you do? Well, he said, first of all, he says, I would build it on building on an island in a lake, and then you wouldn't need any shield. Now that's absurdity number one. So just we would breathe. Well, how would you do that? Well, he said, I'd run the tubes up and down. As a matter of fact, in this report that I was reading the other day, they were apparently very seriously considering running the tubes vertically in the air. And I said, well, how would you do that? Well, he says, you load them in the top, and then when they're ready to be discharged, you take them out the bottom. Well, how would you service that? Oh, with a submarine.
All right.
Well, would you get your operations service? Oh, he said, I would. I mean, this is there was a tone of things, but he, but Fermi is always lined with all these Frankensteins.
Yeah.
One time he figured out how many jackrabbits there were on the project based on the number of road fuels that he had seen in probability.
Yeah. That's what he was doing with the reactor, right? When they first started thinking about it.
Yeah.
Same process.
Well, I remember playing tennis with him one time down Cardamon Park.
Really?
Well,
yeah.
You were talking about going down to Beckman. Bill Porter was into the instruments over in the 200 area.
Yeah.
He was at the University of Chicago there at the time, and one time he said he was on the street and he saw Fermi coming down the street at
a couple other men, and he had been to a lecture where Sarah had been lecturing their group. And so he goes over and starts talking to Mr. Fairman, and he approached him. These other guys swarmed on him that they were his guards. And they thought that since he had a violent
security.
So they really couldn't. But he was he came out on the train with her. These guys' names were always Jeremy was Farmer.
That's right, Mr. Farmer.
And Bill Porter and his wife played bridge with Mr. and Mrs. Farmer. And so after the bomb had been dropped, Bill said to his wife, he said, you know, that Mr. Farmer we played with, the bridge with on the train coming out. Well, that was his interest in there for him. he hadn't realized it.
So let me ask you one specific question I had on the transition for contractors. Basically then, when DuPont was leaving, they offered you jobs, both of you, and you could have left the area and that would have been that, but you both decided to stay on, and you assumed that there was a job here for you?
Well, we were offered a job.
You were already offered a job?
Yeah.
Okay, that had already come up.
So you had a choice.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when you stayed, you were offered the job by the government or by Westinghouse? Who would you be talking to?
GE.
GE, I'm sorry. Yeah. Were they already in on the conversations by the time they actually got here? They talked to you already?
Okay.
So you had two cut and dried black and white suits.
Okay. Yeah, I guess this was basically we'd had meetings before September 30th.
I think we did.
Okay.
Did you ever see the copy of the Villager time of the Villager was when the bomb was dropped?
I've seen the front page picture of it.
Yeah.
People finally found out what the heck they were doing.
As a matter of fact,
you've seen that, so that's good.
There's a book somewhere I saw it.
We were up in British Columbia at a lodge, Little Ian, north of Nelson on the big lake up there. And when we came in they asked us to register at the desk. And the desk, they had the in registered, but there was not an attendant there. So we signed our names and then went on a through room. And as we were going up the stairs, we looked back and three ladies from the parlor came over to see who we knew people who just come in. And so the next day we were out, we'd gone fishing with Al and myself, but our wives were on the veranda. And this lady came over, she introduced herself, she said, I'm so and so from Spokane. I noticed you're at the nursery. What do we do down there? Well, my wife didn't know.
Literally, yeah.
She said, I don't really know. I don't really know, but I understand the woman from Kansas and St. Pete. Well, the lady, obviously, my wife didn't mean it that way, but obviously, the lady from Spokane felt like she'd just been hit in the face with a stick.
Probably
I wonder how many other people knew what the whole scope of the project was. Was it a lot of people? Because the impression I've been under is very few people knew anything.
Well, let's see. We had... We had maybe... might get 8 people there at the archive. Working on the reactor. Mm-hmm. And we had some of them that had gone down to a bridge on the air fuel pile down there. Mm-hmm. I would say about 15 or 20 of we who were at the B reactor.
Okay. Now, some people didn't even know it was a pile. There was a lot of people on Hanford who knew nothing about what was going on.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, and some people knew it was a pile, and radioactive and everything else, but they didn't know what, so what? They might not have known what it was going to be used for.
Right.
And then some people had a picture of what this Manhattan Project was all about. Now, did you know that there was a Los Alamos at the time? They already had mentioned Oak Ridge.
I may not have known in 1934, but some place along there. We knew that. Well, as a matter of fact, we pulled the uranium in under 20 feet of water out in the reactor area for so many days, and then we transferred them into a well car, and you hauled them out of there to go to the 200 area. So I think the 200 north at that time. It's added cooling to them. The first well cars that were shipped out of there, they had a man walk the track ahead of the train to be sure that the track was going to be there when the train went over. When it opened, it went over, and it wasn't going to derail.
So were you surprised when, were you, by the time the war ended and the bomb was dropped, did you know that's what the material was going to be used for?
I think I realized it.
Did you know it officially, though?
Not officially.
Yeah, okay. So you were one that was kind of in between. You knew it was a pile.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I was in the instrument end of the business.
Yeah.
They were measuring.
Hey, they had to get clued in.
Okay. Yeah, right. So we knew that, when I went down to L.A. in 44,
it was
kind of... One of my friends had told me to look up this thing in this book
now,
in the library.
But now
the people in the water department didn't know.
They just knew they had to send you so much water.
That's right.
That was it.
Yeah. And
did you even understand where was science back then that such a thing as an atomic bomb was even possible? Was that in the public knowledge from the 30s and 40s? So I wonder if that was even in the lay public.
I don't think it was generally...
No. So if somebody had known it was radioactive, this or that, it still might not have made them think of what it might be used for. Did you think maybe it was a power plant, just to make power?
No way.
Not making pants in nylon or something?
No way.
Transmuting? How about transmuting elements? Did that ever occur to you? That would have occurred to me.
Yeah.
In making, gold from straw, or straw from gold.
And I was in the university, not too many years before. There was in physics, there was nothing about nuclear.
It happened so quickly.
In the chemistry book, there was nothing about it.
Right. Yep, hadn't gotten that far yet. Yeah. Hey, listen, this has gone on longer than I thought I'd hold you, but maybe I'll get you some other time, but this is very good, and I'd love to be able to get some stuff in the newsletter on a regular basis, and also the whole internet thing, the website, is a whole other issue. That's a bottomless pit of opportunity, basically. Possibilities.
I was trying to think of how to get started. What story particularly would you be interested in putting in the moderator? And so basically, my final thought was, well, maybe this bull session will generate an idea.
I think it's generated 20 or 30 when I sit down and think about it, because we've talked about social issues, family issues, farming, money that you were making, working for different contractors, the science end of it, the fact that you either knew or didn't know what it was doing. And we really haven't talked about the B reactor as such, which will end up being the museum. Forget all this other stuff. It's this building being the only real artifact that everything else comes in on is what's going to be there. So I think there's an awful lot of topics.
I started to tell you this, but we were told in the DuPont building that this was the plant was being built out here to make plutonium, and that we could make a bomb by using plutonium and we could separate it chemically, and that the other was separated piece by piece.
Right.
And that night, well, when we checked in, Carl Mearns and I had been on other places together, and we decided we would room together. And that night, we went back to the hotel and sat on the bed and looked at each other, and we said, what business do you have in getting into something like this? Basically, a moral issue. Is this something you ought to be doing? And basically, my conclusion, I don't know what Charles was, but my conclusion was, well, if the Germans were working on it, we damn well better get there before them.
Yeah. I think in times of war, you don't have the luxury of deciding if something is, how much more moral is it one way or the other, especially when you didn't even know if it could be built. Maybe they already had it. Yeah. Interesting, though, to be able to sit back and look at that time and see what the options were and what the possibilities were. Not too many people had that luxury of seeing the whole picture either. Because really, I mean, there were people working in munitions factories, people building tanks, people building ships, but everybody was involved in that effort in some way or other. And if the bomb hadn't worked, you wouldn't have a story to tell. Think about it. All this business of B-reactor would have been, it was an interesting time, but it never panned out. Well, maybe we can think about this in the future, and maybe zoom in on a couple of little things, and just, you know, the newsletter's not 30 pages long, so we don't need lots of material.
If you can come up with from what you heard, if you can come up with something specific that you can pursue,
I think I'll be able to pull out a little something for this one. There'll be something of interest to get in. The main thing is, I want to not let people know, but make it evident that what this museum group is about is not preserving a bunch of concrete. It's about preserving the stories and the things that went into that concrete. And because if you think about it, anything we build as people, it's not the raw elements that go into it. It's not the rock and the concrete. It's the shape it takes on. And actually, a reactor is a perfect example, because it's the geometry and the thought and the physics and everything that took all these dumb pieces of material and made them do something. The steam engine is too, but a reactor is sort of more self-evident because it was so new and so different and so much based on theory and modern physics. And
you haven't seen the steam engine developed from concept into a being, but it was just a reactor.
Yeah, the steam engine took hundreds of years, basically. And anybody could look at it and make some kind of sense out of it, but a reactor was beyond anybody's comprehension. It was still a steam engine.
Yeah.
But a whole different kind of one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's exciting for me because I grew up after it was already happening. I grew up in the nuclear age, and I grew up learning about air raids and bomb shelters and all that stuff that the Cold War was made of, and you guys got to see the transition. You know, my father saw penicillin come along as a doctor. He was just getting out of medical school when penicillin came along, and it was like, oh, that sure changes the equation. You know, it sure makes life different. So it's interesting seeing just those chunks come along, the historical, the points you put on the timeline.
Yeah.
So the other thing was the idea of having tours out to the B reactor. I think we ought to start that as soon as possible. There's so much inertia in trying to get things going. It seems to me if we could somehow get enough energy up to actually get tours going every quarter or something like that, would really it would make the place look much more like a museum, I think. It would, you know, sort of put it in the public mind, maybe. Yeah. That would be exciting. Plus, I've only been out there once. It would be fun to go back again sometime.
Yeah, I'm talking about that new day. Yeah. Oh, they don't want us.
Do they have any children?
Yeah, I think a lot of people... Trips I've been on, I see very few children. I took a bus tour of Hanford once, and then I went out to the B reactor when you guys had it open. Mm-hmm. And there weren't, like, groups of school kids that I noticed that... You know, they go to Washington, D.C. and look at stupid monuments that we built, you know, it's like, okay, that's great. Yeah. But here's like a real piece of history, yes, but it also, it's science, which everybody wants to get kids interested in. It's out in a beautiful part of the geography and everything, it's out in the desert, and it's a real historical, you know, point in time that I think, if they did start opening it up for tours, you could get school kids coming on buses from different areas. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of possibilities.
Right.
How much I'd be able to participate in helping, I don't know. That's always the problem, right? Sounds like a great idea, but, you know, who's going to do it? Well, this was great. I'm glad you were able to take the time, and maybe we'll get to do it again at some point.
Okay.
I think that'll be good.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed listening to you, Bill, primarily. I didn't contribute nearly as much as you did.
We'll get you, though.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sure there's plenty more stories in there. And it looks like, you think at some point there'd be papers in there that would have some sort of a spark for a concept or a story or a snippet. Yeah, just things that might spark your memory that were different back then. Because one of the problems today, if you took the average worker at Hanford today, and let both of you and him talk about the world and how they live and the money they make and the health insurance and politics and government running things, it would be a really different picture, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Real different picture. Yeah. The government today is not taken as it was 50 years ago. It's very different.
Yeah.
Even when it's doing exactly the same, you know, doing things well or not, even when they're doing the same things, people have a different take on it. It's funny. So maybe we can get some more, and if nothing more, we're not doing the moderator that often, it's not that big, so it shouldn't be hard to get a few little pieces in there from time to time, and maybe get ideas for other things, like, you know, the oral interviews that they were doing. And you were in that movie, right, that the thing that Jerry brought in on the video? That was one you were taped on, yeah. It seems like there's all kinds of possibilities.
Taken out at B? Taken out the videotape?
We had one of them who were in the senior center.
Oh, okay.
They